Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time.
And welcome to the Billboard Sharpie Podcast. It is the most wonderful time of the year because Billboard's VP of Charts and Data Development, Silvio Petrolongo, is making his Sharpie Podcast debut.
Woo-hoo!
It took me long enough, but I'm here. Thank you for having me, Gary.
Thank you, Silvio. And if you recognize that clapping and that voice, Keith Caulfield, Billboard's co-director of charts.
I'm host of the Pop Shop Podcast.
That's the
Gary.
One. I forgot about that.
You have a visitor from Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's actually not that anyone really cares, but we've all worked together now for 10 years. This is like the second time we've all been in the same room together.
Yeah. And we're like, it's like the president and vice president, of the United States.
We can't be in the same room.
If
there's a chart emergency, one of us always has to be available.
We need a designated survivor.
Yes, yes. But now we are all here together, Gary, just for you, only for you and the Chartbeat Podcast.
And for chart fans, and let that be the last presidential mention we make here on the podcast.
I was talking about the TV show, but it's okay.
Good save, Silvio. Well, this should be fun because we get questions from readers all the time about how Billboard charts work and different details about the charts that we don't always get to go into. So let's answer some questions and do something we never do, talk about charts among the three of us.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
All right, the first question, what is Billboard's motto? I think over the years, I mean, you could go back to 1894 when Billboard started. In some ways, it's so different from what Billboard was at the beginning. In some ways, we're kind of doing the same in the way we cover the entertainment business.
We do have a motto.
We do?
It's really long. It's like a mission statement.
Oh.
We had a mission. I don't have it memorized, though. But it's to capture music popularity in the most current forms of consumer consumption. And you know, it's something that Billboard has done since its first national chart in 1940 through the years of vinyl and cassettes and
8-track
and CDs and digital downloads, the quick arrival and quick demise of ringtones popularity to now where it's social based, it's streaming. You know, we still have download sales that are still, viable, though they're slowly declining year to year. Radio's still a harbinger of what is a hit. So we're capturing all of that and the activity that is happening on Facebook and Twitter and everything that plays a part in the social media landscape. So it's all that and there's more to come. So it's a constantly evolving and it's certainly the past 10 years have certainly, have had many different changes, more so than the 30 years prior to that. And we can only expect more to happen.
I wonder how cyclical change is. For people who don't know, Billboard started in 1894, and the name Billboard comes from billboard advertising. It was tracking what was being advertised on billboards when circuses came to town.
Yeah, we didn't cover music.
Right.
We covered actual advertisements on billboards.
I would think if you went through the decades when sheet music became bigger and then when 45s came along, it was billboard teams before us probably went through similar lines of thinking of how everything was changing. Maybe it is more different in the last few years with all the technology.
Yeah, I mean, probably the longest, you know, what would connect to now, going back even prior to our first charts in 1940, was live entertainment. You know,
yeah.
We had a lot of vaudeville coverage and the like. So, and the circuses, as you know, that was part of it too. So it was all live entertainment, which is still, you know, which is now is the biggest money maker for all artists, right?
Yeah.
So it's almost, it's where we began and where we're ending up now as being the main source of how musicians and entertainers can make a viable living.
So we're talking about how trends are cyclical, saying how vinyl to cassette to CD downloads. And with vinyl specifically, it's kind of interesting how that's come back as a niche format, but it's at a really high level now. You never really know what is going to come back. Silvio, you've been here for a while. Does anything still surprise you when you see those kind of trends, when something comes back like that?
I mean, I take that, you know, the vinyl resurgence with, you know, it's sort of a grain of salt. I mean, it's up from totally, you know, from nothing.
It's up from nothing.
From nothing, right? And I mean, but in comparison to everything else, it's still fractional. So it's great to see. It's more the you know, the viability of a music format is not what I think is driving the popularity. It's the uniqueness of the product. And with traditional sales and that being CDs, you know, going away, you know, the industry, labels and artists have taken a more, you know, more conscientious effort to create product that is unique. So there's, you know, the vinyl comes with, you know, great artwork and, you know, on heavy stock, and
there's also something
colored
to
vinyl.
There's
so
something
so
to be said for vinyl that's being sold to young people who never got to experience vinyl the first time around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even me, who is older than the young person that I just quoted, the mysterious young person that purchases vinyl, I barely was around for vinyl. In like, I had like vinyl 7-inch 45s in the 80s, but I didn't really have that many like long playing albums. I was already onto cassettes as a kid.
Right.
And then I quickly moved to CDs like in the very late 80s. And so 12-inch vinyl long playing albums were already out. So for me, even still, to hold a long playing 12-inch vinyl album is a novelty.
Yeah.
And I think kids and younger people, it's something that they never got to actually experience. So it's a whole, to them, it's a whole new format. And it's really exciting to them because it's something they can hold. It's tangible. It's an object. It's like also a piece of art. And because they've been living in a world for so long that is just nothing but digital and virtual and YouTube, where there's nothing to hold on to, it's kind of nice when you can hold on to your favorite artist, but in like this object form. So I think that's why it's coming back so well, and hilariously why cassettes are starting to sell too.
Yeah.
Because it's kitschy, it's vintage, and it's something they haven't had before.
That's a format I had not much of an affinity for, except for recording on.
I grew up on cassettes.
But not, you know.
The single, baby. It's coming back.
You talk about bad sound quality. That was bad sound quality.
What do you mean?
No, I was just in Barnes & Noble. That's all they had was vinyl. There were no CDs.
Barnes & Noble is a big seller of vinyl. Urban Outfitters, yeah. Barnes & Noble. I mean, Urban Outfitters is probably, I think, the second biggest seller of vinyl behind Amazon.
I mean, we have one right around the corner, and you know, just their window display of vinyl is impressive. It catches your eye.
Yeah.
Keith, you,
yes.
Among other things you do, you manage the Billboard 200.
I do.
Where are CD sales going? Are they going away?
I think, I don't know if they're going to go away. That's always the evergreen question. I think Silvio and I were looking up something a couple weeks ago, looking at digital album sales versus CD album sales, and CD album sales still were greater than digital album sales. So at that point, at whatever point we looked up, CD sales were still outpacing digital albums, but not by that much. I think after Christmas, we'll see the normal switch, the normal rush to streams and to digital albums. That always happens after people get their Christmas gifts and whatever new devices and goodies they've purchased and gift cards or they've gotten. That always happens. I'm not sure if CDs are going to totally go away, because I think the format is a very sturdy format. And I think people are going to still want something tangible. It may go away at some point in the future, but I think
it's a long fade.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many adults are used to playing CDs in their car, and that's the only way they don't have a doohickey to hook it up into their car yet. You know,
well, that I mean, it's almost like the phone jack disappearing on the iPhone, and maybe now the Samsung. It's like
you can
say they'll play it in their car, but you know, how many cars are going to have that to play? So it's, you know, the manufacturers force the consumer in a certain direction, and either you adapt or not. But it makes it less available places for you to play it. Retail stores are allowing less space to sell it.
Right.
So it starts to be coming out of sight, out of mind. So you hope that people just don't stop buying music, that they're able to, you know, move to the platforms that, you know, they can enjoy it.
That's where I wonder where sales overall are even going. Are younger generations just growing up with subscriptions to streaming services? Will the thought of actually buying individual albums or songs maybe a generation from now?
Well, I mean,
go away completely.
You know, 10 years ago, we didn't have the, you know, streaming services that we do now, like Spotify and Apple Music. And more people, including myself, are getting very used to, uncomfortable with the idea of just paying a monthly fee and, you know, treating it like their cable bill or their internet bill their phone bill and getting all the music that they want. So is that the future? It's what the industry seems to think is the future. But will that be the future that consumers give them? Because, you know, they, for a long time, you know, CD sales were the bread and butter of everything, and they made tons and tons of money off of that. And then suddenly we had that whole internet thing happen. So who knows what the future will hold? And if we actually knew, then we'd all be fortune tellers.
Measuring a hit nowadays seems more confusing to figure out than in the past. In the 80s, if you were into the 90s, if you were measuring a hit song, it was song sales and radio airplay. Up until very recently, all our album charts were just based on pure sales. Now, there's so many ways you can look at a hit. A song could completely not be a hit at radio, but it could have millions of YouTube views. So something can be a hit a different way. Silvio, especially, you've seen over the years the definition of a hit probably change, again, as we were saying, more than ever in the streaming era.
What makes a hit, you know, has changed. I think ultimately, you know, a hit becomes something that, you know, is in the public consciousness, reaches the mainstream. Most people are familiar with it, and most is, I know that's, you know, it's not the majority, but, you know, a good amount of music fans know what it is. And going back to what I said earlier, you know, we've always, Billboard as a brand has always just tried to make sure that we're measuring the things that reflect that which is popular. So the one thing, and this goes, well, you know, I could throw it to Keith in terms of the album chart, which was our most recent, you know, big change of changing the album chart from pure sales to music consumption, was that, you know, we had a chart of album popularity that only measured the initial impulse of a purchase. So you bought an album, thank you for voting, you know, we'll get you next time you buy another album. Now, we get to measure engagement with product from that album, with titles from that album. I've purchased many albums that I listened to once or twice, and ones I like that I listened to dozens, you know, hundreds of times. And we had no way of knowing that in the past, right? So, you know, now we are getting not only that initial impulse in sales, but we're also getting the continued interaction with the product. And that's exciting. I mean, you can see how the chart has changed since then. It's, you know, if you had a strong first week and you sold 500,000 copies and your fan base was a million, you know, you might reach that plateau in a few weeks or a few months. But if you have an album that's continually generating hits and people are returning to listen to, now that album can, you know, stay in the top 10 for, you know, many, many weeks. And you saw that a lot in the 80s and 90s. A hit-driven album stayed at the top of the chart. The methodology was obviously different then. It was a reporting system and not official measurement. But I think, you know, thanks to technology we have today and thanks to the immediacy of product that's available digitally, you know, we're seeing the total picture of how popular songs and albums are in the many ways that people can listen to them, either on demand or, you know, still through radio, which again to me is still, you know, the final stamp of approval on what becomes a hit, or at least a long-lasting hit. So I think we're in the, you know, the best era we've ever been in accurately measuring music popularity.
Absolutely.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
No matter what way you consume music or listen to music or experience music, we try to capture that. We try to track that. And if it was back in the 50s where you would, you know, plunk a couple coins into a jukebox and that's how people experience music at a diner, we would track that. We actually had a jukebox chart. Right. Or, you know, what was being played on the radio or what you actually bought physically in the store, we tracked that. And that's what we've tracked for years and years and years and decades and decades. And as the decades have passed, we have gotten better and more exact with how we collect this data and just the granular data that we can have, so we can really get a finer point, because we care so deeply about really showing America and the world, like, what are the most popular songs, artists, and albums in the United States. So, and that's great that, you know, we have our partnership with Nielsen and Nielsen Music, and gives us sales information and airplay information that is so detailed. And in addition to that, we also have tons and tons of streaming information and social information about, you know, who's popping on Twitter and who's on SoundCloud and who's doing well, you know, on Facebook. Like, I mean, just things that, you know, so many different ways that people can, you know, experience music. And Billboard is always trying to capture that. And we're constantly trying to find new ways of capturing that as we move forward. And I'm sure in a year or two from now, there will be a couple new different ways that we will be incorporating music experience and music consumption into our charts. So,
no, I was thinking that too, how even recently the Mannequin Challenge, or all these dances,
the viral memes
that have been helping songs in recent years. It's really not that much different from the 60s when you had the twist and the locomotion about dances. It's just the way it's consumed now that's different.
It is interesting, you know, when you have like this sort of, there's the knee-jerk reaction of like, oh, Black Beatles, you know, ooh, viral hit. And there's a sort of like old man, like, get off my yard mentality about, oh, what's this? How is this number one? I'm like, you know what? I have the feeling that adults probably felt the same way about the first time The Twist hit number one.
Right.
And then when The Twist went back to number one, when the adults discovered it a year or two later, it's just like the dance crazes, The Twist and the Peppermint Twist and the other variations of The Twist.
And Gary's Macarena.
Yeah, the Macarena.
Yes, I'm doing it right now. No one can see it. All right, next up, new charts. Are we looking
at any? Nope, we've got none.
We're done?
We're done.
That's it?
Our job here is through. We're working on charts, many other charts. You know, we have I just mentioned the album consumption chart, which brings streams and tracks sales from albums as part of a formula for the top albums. We're going to do that for the various genres soon. It should be very early in the new year. So that is coming.
And that's when we add, when you change charts from just sales-based to consumption-based, we're adding streaming.
Streaming equivalent units and track equivalent units. And Keith, you can run through the mechanisms of that. It's public knowledge.
Yeah. On the Billboard 200, one album sale equals one unit. So if you purchase an album from any of the normal retailers you purchase an album from iTunes to Amazon to Walmart to Target, that counts as one unit. If 1,500 streams of songs from an album are played during the week, that counts as one streaming unit. If 10 tracks are purchased from an album, any of the 10 songs in any configuration, that counts as one unit. At the end of the week, we compile all this and we say, oh, number one this week is with so many hundreds of thousands of units is so-and-so. Of that sum, so many of those were in traditional album sales. Sometimes there could be a huge difference. Like Drake's Views has like, you know, was number one for a very long time because of its power on streaming services. And it didn't sell as many albums as the weeks, you know, went by. But then sometimes you have albums that are overwhelmingly powered by traditional album sales.
And someone asked, noticing how streaming may be more for younger artists, does streaming hurt older artists? And does that come into play when you think about changing charts to be more streaming based?
No, I don't think you can say it hurts older artists. I mean, there's so many factors at play at this. I think you can say the opposite. Not having this kind of activity measured for the chart doesn't properly reflect the activity that's happening around the hit-driven artist. Right. So, right. You know, what is more popular as, you know, the Weeknd album that might sell, you know, 300,000 albums in its first week and then drops down to 100,000 2 weeks ago, again, because the initial surge was there and it's a more passionate, you know, younger fan base going out, and or an older artist that'll sell 100,000 and, you know, end up at number one the week two, or 150,000 end up at week two because, you know, that big hit-driven album had its big surge the week before. So I think having these other pieces in, you know, helps avoid some of these big up and down trajectories that we see sometimes on the charts.
I think you have to think of it less in terms of a chart hurting someone. Billboard's job is not to hurt a demographic or an age group on the charts. Though, obviously, you know, when we look at the charts, we care about how certain artists are represented, and we want to make sure that everyone is sort of correctly represented, especially on a chart like the Billboard 200 or like the Hot 100, which is a blended chart. You know, we blend data together to come up with the correct formula that makes the right amount of sense within the industry. And I think for a couple of years there, for kind of a while, people got used to the idea of seeing sort of heritage acts, so to speak, who would sell a lot of albums, debut very high on the Billboard 200 because you didn't need to sell a whole lot of albums to be high on the Billboard 200 because right. The album sales market became very depressed. And we needed to address that and fix that. And so on the Billboard 200, we incorporated tracks and streams to, frankly, bring the Billboard 200 back to what it should have been representing all along. So I think people just got used to the idea of like, look, this really old metal band is like number two this week. It's their highest charting album ever. Yeah.
It's, and then next week it'd be 15.
And then next week it falls, you know. So I get what that person is saying or what those folks are saying. But it was really just to try to bring the Billboard 200 back in line. What was sort of the reality of the industry.
And yeah. So, and we're not hiding that data, right? You know, no. So for the Hot 100, we have a separate streaming chart of the data that goes into the Hot 100. We have a sales chart and we have an airplay chart. For the albums, we still have a top album sales chart. So, you know, and we still trumpet the fact if someone is number one on that chart and might not be on the Billboard 200. So, you know, we don't, and that we have way too many charts, a big array of charts. But we do that because there's a place for all of this. There's a place for us. There's genres that we need to represent no matter how small or large because they're important to people who make music, and we want them to feel we want to be inclusive of all of that. So we still want to represent data as many different ways as possible, but we have our 10 poll charts, and that's, you know, the Hot 100 and Billboard 200.
And it isn't just Silvio sitting in his office deciding what the industry needs. We talk to people in
we consult with the industry incredibly methodically over a very long amount of time. To make sure that we reach a consensus that makes sense for, you know, these specific, you know, especially the Billboard 200, that was a long process to make sure that we arrived at the right formula because it was such a big, big change.
And yeah, I do have a ton of conversations both internally and externally on this. And, you know, for those listening, you know, Billboard, you know, serves the industry, but we also serve the music fans and consumers. And it's totally important to us that we present charts that are in line with what our music fans, our chart fans, want to see, and also that is reflective of their taste. So there have been many decisions made, which we are leading the conversation in favor of doing things that present our charts the best way publicly. And that might not always be in line with what the industry wants. So it's a tough line to straddle sometimes, but it's something we need to do. Because, yeah, we just don't follow what the industry needs. And in terms of the album consumption chart, there were some rules applied on our side in the U.S. That were different than how some countries overseas were doing it. And, you know, there was talk at one point of trying to all be in line with each other. And, you know, it wasn't the right thing for Billboard to do something, for the sake of how other countries were doing it. We just wanted to do something for our brand and for our readers and for the industry that we serve here in the U.S. But as a global brand, you know, we work with the various data partners. We have Billboard charts in other territories that we work with and that I've helped create charts. We have a Hot 100 in Japan, for example. So every territory is different, and, you know, we try to operate in favor of the music fans and the industry in each of those.
People wonder about, we had a K-pop chart for a while. It was on the website. Yes. K-pop has become so huge. We don't have a K-pop chart now.
We don't have a K-pop chart right now. But we are working towards bringing that back. A lot of our international-based charts, you know, the Japan Hot 100 and the K-pop chart when we had it, are built in conjunction with a licensee in that territory who know the industry.
The K-pop chart also... I want to refresh my memory. The K-pop chart was really just like a top 100 for South Korea, right? It was like they're just...
Right, yeah. That's a good point. It wasn't the popularity of K-pop in the United States. It was a chart based on...
Just like the top 100 songs in South Korea.
Correct.
So it wasn't actually about the genre of K-pop.
Although there was a lot of
K-pop. There was a lot of K-pop on it.
Yeah, the chart was geared towards those kinds of titles in that territory anyway.
They had their own rules for
this
chart.
Exactly. Yeah. So to that point, we work with local... licensees in each of those territories to build proper charts reflective of that country. And the partners we had at the time, you know, are no longer our partners, and we're looking at other options. So hopefully we can revive that in a better way soon.
I would say this for me, I think it's true for you guys, probably the same thing. All this change really keeps everything fun because a whole new type of consumption could come along. I think that change is what keeps us fresh with all this overload of data.
Music's always been a passion. The charts have always been a passion. It's excited me more in my current role that I spend a lot of time trying to build new ideas and new data partnerships and new opportunities for Billboard to expand how we measure music popularity. The past 5 years has just been... crazy. The past year has even been, madness. But it's fun. That's what makes it fun. Where it became difficult was when we were just doing the same thing every week. When it was just Monday radio charts, right? Sales charts, rinse, repeat. So there's still that there, obviously. But myself and Keith and Gary and other members of the department, I mean, each week they're being challenged. By myself and just the industry as a whole to try to continue to innovate and move forward and provide the data that we do in a new and fresh way, whether that's editorially or data driven wise, it's all of that. So it's we have some great meetings each week, and we sit down and just talk about things that we've learned talking to people in the industry, reading the email, looking at comments on the website, and we notice something every week that surprises us on how hits become hits, how people are interacting with music and their artists that they like. So it's the freshness now that makes it exciting, and the great unknown of where we're going.
And I think we all like how music means so much to people. It may sound cheesy. It's really an honor to present this information to people. It makes people happier to know what's going on in music. That's a good thing.
This is why we take our jobs so seriously, yeah. And why we, people listening, we agonize over things that may seem like minutia. But to us, like, we want to make sure that, you know, if you're only a handful of copies away, or you're, you know, we want to make sure that, like, if we know it matters to people, that if you're on the chart, we want to make sure that we have the data correct. We want to make sure that you're properly represented, because we care so deeply about the charts, and we know that artists do, and fans do, and the industry does. And so we take our jobs incredibly seriously. We also think it's also a fun job to have, too. I mean, it's a nice combination of, it's an important job, but it's also very fun at the same time.
Yes, it's fun.
Who's your favorite meet and greet you've ever had, Silvio, with an artist?
Personally, you know, it was a recent one, too. It was just in January this year. I got to meet my favorite artist of all time, and that's Billy Joel.
Wow.
And it was really just like eight people backstage.
Were you just like sweating like a madman before you got to meet him, and like nervous?
I was not overly nervous, but a certain amount of tenseness, which I don't get anywhere else, you know, with any other artist. So it was good, because, you know, the first time you meet somebody you really, really like, and I'm sure, you know, any fan out there that wants to meet their artist, you don't want that to be a disappointment. You mm-hmm. don't want to say something stupid.
30 seconds could undo 30 years.
You know, you could practice a line that you want to say to them, and it's never going to come out right. And, you know, I had that sort of fear, but it turned out well, and we did get to talk a little bit, and it was fun. So, yeah, that was great. I mean, there are a ton of artists out there, and for the fans who get the opportunity to, you know, to meet their artists, it's always a special occasion.
Yeah.
Happy New Year. Thank you both.
Have a great holiday, everybody.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.